Jackson and work together to help in your community.
Way down here, you need a reason to move. Feel a fool, running your stateside games. Lose your load, leave your mind behind, baby Jane. Oh, Mexico, you sound so simple, I just got
back on downtown. Time for Sports Lit 101 on this Wednesday afternoon. And yeah, we're going to talk about Mexico, specifically the 1968 Summer Games at Mexico City, as Bruce is here for Sports Lit 101. And Bruce, why don't you introduce our two guests? We've talked about their work a number of times, but excited to have them with us.
Yes, we have Sean Anderson and Emily Pleck, and I'm saying Pleck correctly with a hard C, yes, who are here, and they have written a wonderful piece in Sporting Realities that has to do with an event which they look at in I think, a refreshing and different way than we've seen. We've had John Carlos on the show. We've talked about this in other ways. But let me ask you, Emily, first. When we see this in America, most people look at this event, the 1968 Olympics, when Carlos and Smith raised their fist during the medal ceremony, as a seminal moment in American civil rights struggle, which it is. But you guys put it in a broader context, and I think in a really wonderful way. And I wonder if you could sort of talk a little bit about that.
Sure. Thank you so much for having us on the show. The challenge with looking at something like the 1968 Olympic Games is placing it in both its historical context and then also looking at how that narrative has been revised over time. So yes, when I sat down and saw this footage for the first time, I was moved and I interpreted it exactly as you described. But as I went back and began doing more archival research, I found that the response in 1968 and in the years that followed the demonstration was not the celebration of this iconic civil rights movement and moment in history. It was in some communities, and it certainly was in some sectors of the press, but the mainstream white press really villainized Smith and Carlos, and they felt that acutely in their personal lives, as I'm sure John had the opportunity to share with you on the show.
Yes, I never had any respect for Brent Musburger after that. After he just called them disloyal, unpaid. I mean, it was terrible what he said. Sean, what drove you to this collaboration and to look at this event the way you guys have?
You know, great question. And it's what Emily said, you know, at the end of what she was just talking about. It was, you know, I think many people saw it as this symbolic sort of, oh my God, the greatest heroic sport event ever. But it was a lot of tragedy. You know, it was a lot of vitriol that they received because of that, not only at the games, but of course, once they went back to their homes. And you know, typically when you think about the Olympics is that when you perform and you know, engage in that type of sport, you have these speaking engagements and you become a celebrity of sorts outside of the game. And that just wasn't it. And to discuss that and write that in this chapter, I thought was very important.
You guys also bring back Peter Norman, who was completely forgotten in all this, the Australian sprinter who actually came in second. If you could, I don't know which one of you wants to do this, to talk about Norman, where he came from and why it's so remarkable that he became friends with these guys in spite of all the negativity that went along with what was a very simple protest.
Yeah, international competition certainly introduces athletes to one another. So I'm sure Smith and Carlos and Norman knew of each other and possibly had even raced against each other prior to this games. But the kind of relationship that was formed, Norman being an Australian who was raised with a strong spiritual and religious opposition to racism in his own country, particularly anti-Aboriginal racism and whites-only policies, saw that moment, behind the scenes after the race was run, had an opportunity in the locker room to talk with Smith and Carlos, And most folks know this part of the story, but having only had one pair of black gloves, it was Norman who suggested that they each wear one of them and raise opposite fists. And then also recognized that he wanted to stand in solidarity with them, but knew that it was also not his place as a white man to engage in a similar kind of demonstration. So in the photos and the imagery, you can see him wearing his Olympic Project for Human Rights button, which was his way of nonverbally demonstrating alongside them. That conversation prior to the medal stand ceremony was the beginning of a lifelong connection, relationship, and friendship that lasted until Norman's death. And it was his son, Matt Norman, who made the documentary Salute to honor his father and recognize the role he played in that important moment.
Right. I wanted to talk to you about the two movies. I could not get a copy of Salute. I tried. I did see Fists of Freedom, the story of the 1968 Olympic Games. When you look at those movies today and you look at where we are today, do they resonate in the same big way they did, or are they just really documentaries about something that happened? What do you think, Sean? You're nodding your head.
I was thinking, back then, you know, I think the platform, the message was very big, you know, because it was attached to, I would say, the latter part of the civil rights movement. And so that in and of itself was, so, you know, it was a watershed situation. But what I see that's similar and a little different nowadays is the fact that, you know, you have several prominent athletes talking about the issues, but also pushing for policy change, you know, which is, I'm sure, something that was being done back then, but at least through media, not as, you know, perpetuated, you know, it was not as popular, you know, of course. But we see that now. And in 2020, when we saw just the rise of this or revitalization of athlete activism, you know, I think that's where we saw the proverbial torch being passed, and it's pushing us forward in new direction.
Well, yeah, and that gets to my next question, and that's that Harry Edwards had a lot to do with organizing the African-American athletes to make some statements at the Olympics, knowing that that's the world stage. That's the big party. It only happens every 4 years.
Right.
But do you think that sometimes Harry sort of hit the attention paid to him, Rob Smith and Carlos, a little bit of the due of what they're due for their courage? I mean, that was no small thing. That was no small thing to do. And it's 4 years after the Voting and Civil Rights Acts get passed. I mean, I'm old enough to have been in the Jim Crow South in the early 1960s. So when 68 rolled around, that was a monumental thing to me. But I wonder if over time, Smith and Carlos haven't faded a little bit, and some of the other players have been built up a little.
Yeah, you know, I would agree in many ways, because I think with Dr. Edwards, he was able to toe the line of both action and sociology, you know, academics. And so he was able to get into a lot of his writings. You know, he wrote his book. That's a classic, you know, and those are some of the things that he was able to use to carry on, to consult with various sport organizations over the years. So I believe that was his way of keeping the momentum alive, and also a platform for relevancy in seeing the marriage of sport and politics, or sport and society, however you want to say it. And so I believe that was the way that, not to say to overshadow those who actually demonstrated, but in a sense, that was his way of pushing the agenda forward, I believe, even beyond them.
Yeah, the recent Sport Literature Association conference, I'm a member, we had a panel presented on collaboration. Yeah. And how it does seem now in sports literature, we're seeing something that we're used to seeing in the sciences, right? Four PhDs do a program on protoplasm none of us understand. But it seems to be more and more in sport literature, people collaborating. How did that work for you guys? Yeah, I'd like to hear from both of you. Emily, you can go first. Just tell us, how did it work for you?
Well, it was a wonderful experience. You know, Sean and I met at a conference some years after I had written my dissertation on the 1968 Olympic Games and the Black Boycott Movement. And we had this opportunity with the Sporting Realities volume to publish a chapter. And Sean was doing much more contemporary research looking at the influence of media representations of Blackness and Black athletes in particular. So it was sort of a natural, once we started having the conversation, I said, you know, I've got to start on something and I would love for you to, you know, join in and really bring the project up to this particular moment. And so it was a very easy collaboration. I think our writing styles meshed pretty well together and we were able just to sort of bounce things back and forth. But the main premise, the way in which rhetorics of racism still circulate in sports discourse, the way in which the protest tends to still be sort of presented to us as an individual thing, not part of that broader collectivist movement. Those are tensions that we both feel are still really need to be addressed and examined in sports protest today.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
Just to piggyback off of that, you know, Emily was right. You know, we were actually at the conference and I think we were in a meeting to figure out how to talk about sport and society in the classroom. So that was a great thing there. But, you know, to even add to that, it's this in sports, we have this sort of hero complex, right, where the athlete comes and saves the day or in a sense wins the game for people. And, you know, we go on and live happily ever after. But what we don't see is that real, that sometimes taboo in sport that's not really covered. Or in this sense, thinking that, you know, while this was a very monumental movement and statement that they made with the fist, there was a lot of aftermath that took place. And I think our synergies met, you know, to discuss this and write this out and flesh this out. And, you know, I can see a lot of future work going forward.
Great. We're talking with Sean Anderson, Emily Pleck, their contribution to Sporting Realities. Sean, this is Rich. Both of you, I'm sure, have heard this before. When people see protests today, I always love it when they say, sports and politics should be separate. They have no place. And my first response is, have you paid no attention to the last 90 or 100 years of sport?
Right. You know, we've seen instances where, you know, years ago, Black jockeys were a thing and they were making the equivalent of millions of dollars. And then by the 1920s, you know, late 1800s to 1920s, they were kicked out of the game. I mean, that was a level of politics there. And it just, like you said, it's gone on through the last 100 years. I think people see these athletes as just, you know, you're my entertainment. I want to get away from the world. I want to just be entertained for these 3 hours. But athletes, again, are saying, you know, hey, we're human too. We have problems. We have things that we want to fight. You know, you can't shut us up. We have the media power now to keep it pushing. And so, you know, it's an unfortunate thing, but sport and politics, it's a marriage that's here and it's here to stay.
Yeah, I think we're it's definitely here to stay. One of the other things we talk a lot about in the Sport Literature Association is how sports figures from the past have become lionized and heroized and you know, nobody wants to know how much Babe Ruth drank or how many times Mickey Mantle was doing something he shouldn't have been doing. But now the new modern athlete is under a microscope like never before. There's no place to run and no place to hide. Do either of you find that lens is often focused in a much more derogatory light on athletes of color than white athletes?
You know, I can't answer that question because I haven't studied it as systematically, perhaps, as you have. But I do think that Black athletes in particular and athletes of color in general often are singled out when they do engage in political activism, and much of the sort of political activity of white and particularly white conservative athletes goes unspoken, as though it's the norm and the expectation for all who achieve a certain level of income and fame. So I think in that sense, there's greater scrutiny. You know, we need only look at Colin Kaepernick, you know, and no further to see how media sort of fixates on some of the negative perceptions of the politicization of sport and then singles out a particular athlete when, as Sean mentioned, this is a longstanding marriage that has always been there and politics have always been writ through sport.
You know, to even get off, piggyback off of that, you know, it's funny, you know, years ago, you would see maybe one or two letters to the editor, you know, about a certain athlete that just made somebody mad that day. But now, you know, social media is so powerful, right? You know, you can have someone with maybe not a profile picture of themselves or some type of profile picture of Bugs Bunny or something, you know, going at it with an athlete, you know, sending out these Twitter threads saying how much they hate them, they should be ashamed of themselves. But one thing I would say the athletes are doing nowadays is they're actually fighting back. You know, you have outlets such as the Players Tribune, where athletes just even last year talked about, for example, the importance of Juneteenth prior to that being made a holiday, right? And so, you know, it's a much harder way to live in our society because you're constantly on via social media. But I do believe that athletes can also use that to share their voice and opinions on things, which may make things a little better. But we can also see that it's murky to navigate that as well.
We're also seeing, I think, a lot of athletes who come into professional sports already understanding that this can be part of the job, that part of the responsibility, but also part of the privilege of being a high-profile athlete is the opportunity to have a forum and to try and use it for good.
You know, it's funny because I listen to Charles Barkley every time he's on Inside the NBA, and he said, you know, kind of like what you just mentioned, you know, it's part of the game. You get $25 million to dribble a basketball, but all of the other stuff, the stuff from the fans, the stuff from the media, all of that comes with it, you know. And it was his sort of take on mental health in sports, and I know that's another subject for another day. But in many ways, yeah, I you know, athletes can use that to get the proper contracts that they would want, you know, to talk about issues that are going on in their communities, you know, to talk about building schools and talking about voting rights and just building platforms for people who may not have a voice. As Emily mentioned earlier, you know, we're talking about Colin Kaepernick. He has his whole Know Your Rights campaign, a website that talks about all of these things and all of the monies that he's donated to different organizations since he started his protest. So, again, it's a very powerful tool. It could be negative at times, but it is a powerful tool to make change.
When you look back on 1968 Olympics and you look back at Carlos and Smith, do you see that as important an Olympic event as an American Olympic team event? Was it more important to us, in other words, or was it just as important to the whole world?
I think to the whole world. I mean, we just saw the Olympics not too long ago, the ones that had to be done last year because of COVID and everything. And we began to see many people protest, you know, on the podiums. I forgot the athlete's name who put up the X at her protest saying, this is for all of the people who are marginalized, you know, all in between. And I think for the world, that was something because we talk about it. I'm quite sure many of those athletes knew about the 68 Olympics, and that's why they engaged in all of the protests at these past Olympics. So definitely something that's important for the world.
Well, I think if I can add that the Olympic Project for Human Rights, which was the larger umbrella organization, really was internationally focused, even though it was composed predominantly of U.S. American athletes. Their focus then and some of their aims, you know, were targeted at apartheid South Africa and the fact that, you know, they'd been readmitted to the games, even though the government had not met the stipulations of the International Olympic Community. So I think these athletes often have a much more global perspective. And as a result, their demonstrations have global impact.
Well, thank you both very much. I hope that we'll talk to you again sometime. Hope we'll see you at SLA one year and you get a new article together. Let us know about it. Thank you very much. Emily Pleck, Sean Anderson, have a great rest of your day.
You too. Thank you, Bruce and Rich.
Sports Lit 101. We'll take a break here. We're 9 to go.